we have a cold opening? No?
Yeah, no cold opening this week. Misty and Rashi are off undergoing CIA training somewhere up north at a secret enclave. I don't know exactly what the CIA needs with a magician and a homicidal sock monkey, but I assume we'll find out in a couple of weeks when they return. So in lieu of any jokes, I'm just going to say, this is our cold opening. Really stinks. Okay, cue the music, Ezra. Thanks. Hello, welcome to Radio Rashi and to Almost Live with Paul and Misty. And Misty's not here this week. This is Paul Dini and I'm flying solo. Well, never solo because we've got Ezra and Emily here also.
Hello.
And I'm very delighted to have a special guest this week. The wonderful, the one and only, the awesome Alan Burnett.
Hello, hello, hello.
Writer par excellence. wonderful producer, a man I've had the honor of working with for many years at Warner Brothers Animation on such shows as Batman, Superman, oh God.
Batman Beyond.
Batman Beyond.
Crypto.
What's that?
Crypto.
Crypto. Mm-hmm. A couple of direct-to-video projects and just, you know, super guy who I've known for years and who is can often be found around you know, visiting over here. So we thought it was high time that he come over and join in on one of the podcasts.
Welcome. Glad to have you.
Well, good to be here.
Well, I guess...
Can you talk about Misty for a second?
Yeah, sure.
Can you say what she's doing?
Misty is... I'm probably screwing it up, but she is doing CIA training to become an expert in lie detection. She is becoming a human lie detector, which... I think would be a very good talent for a magician to have.
So you can't get away with anything anymore.
Never. I never could. I never could because she does have that ability to look at me and say, what have you been up to as if I don't know? And she always catches me in the act, even before I do anything. So I'm never going to get away with anything anymore. Nothing. So she is up there learning that. It sounds fascinating. For a while, I wanted to take the class, too. I was interested in it, but... I just couldn't swing the time away. It's like, it's half a month up, you know, learning these secrets from people like connected with, I think, Scotland Yard. You know, there were investigators from Scotland Yard today.
Wow.
And law enforcement agencies. But she actually, by the time she's done, if I'm not mistaken, she will actually be licensed to go into meetings with police departments and interview people and discern if they're lying or not.
And so she's the only magician right now, right?
She's the only magician who's gone through the course.
Jury selection people, do they take this thing too?
I don't know.
Can anyone sign up for it?
Yeah, well, there is like an interview process where they kind of, you know, why do you want to take this thing? And I think they've actually turned down some other magicians, but... I think they, you know, Misty, you know, pled a good case, and they
can't trust Siegfried and Roy.
No, I don't know. I think that only works if you're interviewing a tiger or something.
Yeah.
I will not bite you. It's like, yes, he will. But so that'll be fun. So we miss her. She'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Meantime, we're just carrying on. And when she doesn't return, we'll have the whole story of. What happens? I have no idea why Rashi went with her. I mean, Rashi doing working for the CIA scares me. I've seen a gun in that monkey's hands, and it does not instill confidence. I think he's, you know, hoping to get a job in black ops or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, less thrilling was what you and I did last week. We went to
WonderCon.
WonderCon up in San Francisco.
Yep, I was on like three panels.
Really?
Wow.
It's like a record. So, animation writing, which actually wasn't a bad panel this time.
No, usually that's a real stinker.
Yeah,
oh,
usually,
really?
Yeah, it's just what are animation writers going to say? That's going to interest anybody. And then there was we had the Green Lantern Emerald Knights.
Yeah,
yes.
Premiere.
I got to thank you for bringing that out because I love Green Lantern. Both the last fight, first flight, and I can't wait for Emerald Knights.
Well, this one was more explosions per minute than in any other one we've done.
When does it come out?
Early June. I want to say June 7th, but don't pin me on that.
And when does the movie premiere? Around the same time?
Gee, I think it comes out the 17th.
Okay. So, but it's in June, and so it's like a month before Comic-Con.
So, any nice factoids about it? Like, is Guy Gardner by chance in this one or anything?
No, it's Hal Jordan.
It's a Hal Jordan story.
But all the other thousands of Green Lanterns are in it, at least in the background.
Yeah.
But it's individual stories that we sort of hooked together as stories from the trenches, war stories from the trenches.
Very cool.
So, yeah, it worked out pretty well.
Sounds good.
So that was that one. Then the Dwayne McDuffie panel. So.
Oh yeah, that was Saturday. I couldn't make that. I'd made my. I wasn't exactly sure when the tribute panel to him was, and I'd made my reservation before I found out that it was Saturday, and I was gonna come back on Saturday. But I wouldn't have made it anyway. I was deathly ill when I got up there. Yeah. I was okay, and then Friday I almost passed out. I'd have a bad cold and sinus, and you can probably hear it there. But I knew that. That was going to happen. Can you say what happened on the panel?
There was Bruce Timm and Matt Wayne and Glenn Maracami and Eddie Braganza.
Was Stan there for that?
Stan was in the audience and he said a few things. Eddie works in of course in DC Comics.
Sure.
And Glenn was producer of Ben 10, and then Matt Wayne is his best friend. So they go back together like at least 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dwayne was such a wonderful talent and such a tremendous person to know.
Tremendous guy.
Yeah.
And a genius.
Yeah.
A literal genius.
Yeah.
We used to at the end of the day, I used to go in his office and shoot the bull. And we would talk about all kinds of stuff, and especially physics. And he never... And one time I said to him, how do you know so much about physics? And he said, well, I got a degree in it. He never told me. And he went to college when he was 12. So when I say he was a literal genius, he really was.
Oh, yeah.
But he'd never tell anything. Oh, by the way, that is the dog you're hearing.
Yes, that is Muggsy snorting
a little bit. Muggsy agreeing with me. So he was a great fellow.
He's the most modest, unassuming guy. And when I would go into his office at Warner's, I don't think he had anything on the wall, or very little, but very nice, very personable to talk to, and everything.
Yeah.
And always made a big splash with every run he did, whether it was on Justice League or Fantastic Four and his cartoons. He was always a phenomenal storyteller.
Yeah. And there are times I feel like, you know, like I'd see him around the comic book store and I'd say, I really like, you know, your run on Justice League or, you know, whatever it was he was doing. And I'd say, like, you know, why do you not make more noise about this stuff, you know? And I think he was just very modest about that. And I think he, you know, the work mattered to him. I would have liked to have seen him get a little more acclaim for the things he was doing while he was doing, as far as the, you know, the great comic book work and the creations, you know, that he came up with and things like that. But it's nice to see him, you know, finally get his due. And
well, you know, he had a wealth of material that he created and the characters, and it didn't hit you that oh my gosh, this is an amazing legacy until he was gone, and suddenly you were going, oh my gosh, and he had striking success in animation writing. I mean, he had
Static Shock
and Justice League and Ben 10, and Ben 10 was going on for another 40 episodes. I mean, it was a phenomenal career.
I always liked working with him on Justice League because usually, I mean, I didn't work on the show regularly. I was sort of like a pinch hitter writer who'd come in and write like one or two episodes a season. But I remember the first one I did, it was a Flash two-parter. I was working on the outline and my hands got all screwed up. I came down with really bad carpal tunnel and I couldn't even type.
Wow.
And it was like...
That was mentioned.
What?
That was mentioned at the... that he ended up on the Justice League because you couldn't type.
I know, I couldn't. Wow. But there was like a period for like 3 weeks my doctor says you can't type. And I was going around with splints and I had to get the thing done. And it's just like if Dwayne can do it, great, you know. And he took it and wrote a two-parter, and it was awesome. It was a great episode.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable that he's gone. 49.
Yeah.
He read the... You know, I was told he read a book a day.
I believe it.
And then I was told I was told later on he read 3 books a day. And I said to his wife, "What is this 3 books a day business?" And she says, "True." He said, "I said, well, what, how did he up his reading?" Well, he got a Kindle,
it's just everywhere.
Yep, he was just reading. He was just the speed reader of all time, I guess.
He's like Icon, you know, the hero from another planet.
Yeah,
it was just.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
But it was a nice panel that we had for him.
Oh, that's good. Did you get to see some? You saw our old boss Jean McCurdy while you were up there too, right?
Yeah, I did. I had dinner with her.
Nice.
And she's doing well. She's in. She's planning a trip to Europe. So
very nice.
That's a great life.
Now, is she doing anything in animation currently? I knew that for a while she was talking about consulting. Or
she was doing some consulting lately, mm-hmm. But I'm not sure right now what she's doing. She's involved in a lot of political stuff up there, and she enjoys that, a lot of socializing.
Did you buy anything while you were up there?
I bought nothing. I never buy anything. In fact, you know what? My wife was up there, and my wife is not a comic book person, and so we ended up just doing a lot of shopping around town when we weren't called for, when I wasn't on a panel, mm-hmm. you know. So it was fun.
San Francisco is the best city to eat in just about anywhere, and I went out several times to my brother and his wife. They're just newlywed. They live up there, so I went out for Chinese food with them one night, and that was awesome. Then one night I just got hungry and wanted to run down to the Mission like 1 a.m. and get a burrito. And there are places down in the Mission District that are just opened at 1, and you can go in there, and everybody from locals to freaks to hipsters to street people to mariachis. There was a mariachi sitting in the place 1 a.m. morning playing guitar, and you have to keep an eye on your burrito because somebody will come in off the street and eat it right at your table and run off with it.
Wow.
So it's pretty colorful down there at Taqueria Cancun at 1 a.m, stuff like that. But I love San Francisco. And that's why I love WonderCon. I like going to the convention. But other than the one panel I did with you, I did no fan stuff. I didn't sit any place. I didn't sign anything. I didn't, I wasn't promoting anything. I just was there to go to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And enjoy myself.
And it was like 50-50 with me.
Yeah.
I did my duty, but then I went out and saw the city.
Well, the place I always wind up blowing a lot of money is that Bud Plants booth, where they have all the art books.
Uh-huh.
It's like Christmas. I go there, and he's always got a nice display, and it's always jam-packed with people, so you have to wedge yourself around in there. And he's always got figurines, that you just have to have, and then books from every artist you've ever liked. They're all there. And then I get a stack of them, like, woohoo, like I'm checking books out of the library, and then it's like $250 later, I'm carrying massive ripping bags back to the hotel, wondering why did I do this?
See, I don't have that. I don't have that consumer comic book purchasing thing.
Yeah.
I just don't.
I'm working my way out of it. I get a little bit better every time, and I go, do I really need all these vintage Peanuts figures? Do I need every one of these? Do I need everything Carl Barks ever
did?
Yes, I do. But leave one behind, just leave one behind.
So you can come back next time.
Yeah, yeah. Either order through the catalog or else get it San Diego. But yeah, it was a fun time. The flights were kind of a disaster. Taking Southwest up there, my flight back was canceled, and so I had to go to the airport and wait and get another. Misty was on the phone, and she it took literally hours to get on another flight because you get on the phone and it's like, you can help yourself at our website and do it on our website because we don't want to answer the phone. So I was on the phone with her, we got on the website, she got me on the next flight, and then it wouldn't close the deal somehow. It would be like, type this in, you should be on the flight. Oh, an error has occurred. Talk to somebody on our phone. And finally, I just gave up and just went to the airport and hung around until I got a flight back.
Well, I told you that flights, it's because of the knocking a plane off of the schedule, the tickets got up to $800 going back.
Oh.
New tickets.
So people had to change their tickets?
Yeah.
Oh.
So,
Well, I would have, if I hadn't felt so damn bad, I would have actually rented a car, which was kind of a mistake. But I would have kept the car, and I would have driven back to Burbank.
Well, for $800, you could have gotten a guy to drive you.
You
could have gotten your own limo and gotten down.
I think $800 is what I paid to rent for the car for those 2 days, because there was like a special deal for $80, I could get a rental car for 2 days. But I get over to the Marriott and I hand my keys to the guy, and he goes, it's $59 a night to park. Huh. It's like, no, the car doesn't have to have a room, it's just a parking space. That is for a parking space. But literally, that was for half my room rate.
I know.
The car had stayed there 2 nights. And I'm thinking, like, schmuck, it would have been less to take a taxi in. And But I don't know. I was seeing people and driving around the city, so you know, it actually worked out about the same. I like driving in San Francisco.
Yeah, well,
I'm one of the few ones who does.
You are one of the few ones who do.
Yeah.
Driving isn't bad. It's the parking. That's what's bad.
Yeah, driving on the one-way streets is terrifying.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I never could figure that out. And I would get like half a block before I'd realize, hey, I'm the one driving the wrong direction. Yeah. I better spin around quickly before they...
You know, I think the whole city is like 4x4x4 miles. You know, 4x4 miles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's not that much bigger than Burbank.
No. I mean, a lot of it came back to me because I lived there for 4 years when I worked at Lucasfilm. And I would drive around the city, you know, when I was in, you know, Marin County. And so I did get the lay of the land pretty quickly when I lived there. And then you have to kind of acclimate yourself when you get back. But I don't know. It's you're right. The parking is just ghastly. The first night I was there, I got together with Mark Evanier and Len Wein and Marv Wolfman. And we all went to the Club Fugazi to see Beach Blanket. At Babylon, yep. Which has been running there since the Cretaceous era, you know, forever. And I got up there, and the parking in North Beach is actually, it wasn't that bad because there was a parking. I got there early enough, so I was able to get a parking spot for $8 for all night. And I thought, man, that's a good deal. And they hike the prices up after a certain time, and then at some point you just can't park anywhere. And that was the most frustrating thing. I do remember when I lived there around. I don't know, 86 to 89 was the parking, even when I lived there, was just awful.
Yeah, sometimes you're better just parking in Oakland and taking the BART over.
Well, it got so bad that I was actually, at one point, my folks sold the house that we grew up in. I grew up in a little town called Orinda over in the East Bay near Berkeley. And my folks moved into the city to a big apartment in Pacific Heights, which was only like 3 blocks away from me. And they had 2 parking spaces. I always had to fight at the place where I was living for a parking space. Finally, when my folks moved to the city, I just said to them, can I park at your apartment? So I would actually garage my car at their apartment building, nice. Then walk 3 blocks to my apartment. And that was actually more convenient than trying to fight with my landlady to get the one parking space in front of her building. Yeah. So, San Francisco tales.
Well, we took long walks, my wife and I.
Yeah.
And we went up Knob Hill. We walked up Knob Hill, which was no fun.
Wow.
But I told you I saw a couple Hitchcock buildings.
Yeah.
And that was kind of thrilling. I saw the building, I guess it's called, I forget what the hotel is called now. St. Mark, something like that.
Oh,
The Mark. It's a Mark is in the name. But it was the hotel that Kim Novak walked out of.
Okay.
And when Jimmy Stewart was following her around, it was where her character supposedly lived.
Is that the one at the very top of the hill there, near the
top
Fairmont?
Of the hill, yes.
Okay.
Near the Fairmont.
Is that the Mark Hopkins or something?
Mark Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. The top of the Mark. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then what's the word?
Kitty corner.
Kitty corner to that was the hotel that she, as he followed her around town, it was the hotel where she ended up, which was I think it was called the Pacific Club now.
Right, right.
And which is a dark brown structure. And she walks into this hotel and you see her open a window at the top. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Stewart follows her inside, but nobody's seen her come in. I mean, it was fun to see these sights. I'm a big Hitchcock fan, so it was fun.
Vertigo is a great movie too. Yeah.
Vertigo is terrific. It never fails to suck me in.
Hitchcock loved shooting in San Francisco. That pet store at the beginning of The Birds is in Maiden Lane, near Macy's, off in a little alley. And I think it actually was a pet store when I was a kid, because I do remember being at the location and saying, oh, this is where they shot part of The Birds.
Yeah.
But a lot of movies shoot in San Francisco, and you can find little bits of memorabilia here and there. And like on Union Street forever, there was a deli that had a park bench in front of it with a little plaque that said, Woody Allen sat here and ate lunch while shooting Play It Again, Sam.
Yeah.
And it was always known as the Woody Allen bench, you know, and it's such a weird thing to find in California, anything with Woody Allen on it, because he just, you know, he's notorious for not, well, I guess Los Angeles, he doesn't like very much. No. But I know he did shoot Play It Again, Sam in San Francisco. I don't think he directed that. That was Herbert Ross, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a strike or something that kept them from shooting it in New York, so they moved it to San Francisco. And I think it suits the movie pretty well, the San Francisco locations. I was watching a lot of Woody Allen the last couple of weeks.
Yeah,
I like his movies an awful lot.
Yeah, yeah, he's great.
Yeah. You know, there's a certain sameness to some of his movies because he goes over the same themes over and over again.
He's been getting a lot more artistic lately, though, doing like more, you know, his foreign film takes with that Colin Farrell one he did.
Was that Match Point or Scoop?
Yeah, Match Point, I think that was.
I heard that was good. I didn't see that, and then I was warned away against Scoop.
Is that Colin Farrell?
Well, there was one about the two brothers.
That was the one I was thinking.
I mean, he makes them so fast. There's like one that comes, you know, it's like a...
They start to mesh.
Yeah, they do. And it's always like, you know, guys looking for love. And, you know, there's always a girl who's unattainable, who's with somebody else, but who in the last minute comes with him anyway.
Sandra's Dream. That was the one that was thinking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think his best movies for me are the ones that have a little bit of... You know, you don't think of him really as a fantasy film director, but something like Zelig has a weird touch of the bizarre to it.
Almost, oh, definitely.
Almost like a Charles Adams cartoon, you know, like... Not an Addams Family cartoon, but, you know, like a little bit of a freak show quality to it. And I love that movie. Zelig and Hannah and Her Sisters is probably my favorite. You don't really need to see another Woody Allen movie other than Hannah and Her Sisters.
Oh, you always need to see Bananas.
Yeah.
Bananas.
And Sleeper.
Sleeper.
Classic.
Yeah. Yeah. There are some real gems scattered here and there, and I like it when he mixes it up a little bit. Radio Days I saw a few weeks ago.
Watch that because you keep mentioning it.
Yeah. You know, and I was watching that and I was thinking, like, this is sort of like the Jewish answer to Christmas Story. I mean, they're remarkably similar in the fact that they take place in almost the same year, like around 1940. They're both about kids who listen to the radio. They're both about kids obsessed with secret decoder rings.
Mm-hmm.
Except Christmas Story is more like a warm look back at someone very nostalgic for the past, where Radio Days is someone who kind of, like, the kid in there seems more interested in growing up, because we can see that he's getting attracted to girls and flirting and kissing with them under the boardwalk and everything like that. But there's still movies, I think, that are kind of a remarkable, you know, different sides of the same coin. And
did you ever see him?
See who?
Woody Allen at a in New York.
In New York?
Yeah.
No.
You never saw him at the
playing the jazz?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, I saw that documentary Wild Man Blues though, and that was great.
It was wonderful. Yeah. I saw him when he was out here and at the Writers Guild for Match Point.
Oh, okay.
Did an interview. It was fascinating. Very down-to-earth fellow.
Yeah. Oh, I did see him in person one night at Trader Vic's here in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And it was before they closed the old Trader Vic's, and they turned it into a much more modern tiki bar. It still exists over at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, but they had a full restaurant. And one night I was in there and I was leaving, and I see this kind of stooped, kind of whiny older man, angry about, not angry, but just like, I don't like what they do here. You know, he's like kind of whining, and he's got this young Chinese woman with him, and she's going, And it was Woody Allen and Sun Yu Previn, and they were just coming in to, you know, have some dinner at Trader Vic's.
I remember she walked at the end of being at the Writers Guild, she walked down the aisle toward him, all heads turned, I mean.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She was just, it was fascinating. You heard so much about her, I finally saw her.
Yeah.
The sight of Woody Allen in person, you know, when I saw him, and I realized it's Woody Allen right here in Trader Vic's, and in Los Angeles, no less. It's like a Martian that had landed or something.
It's wrong.
What?
It's wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a big part of me that just wanted to, you know, scream his name and grab him and shake his hand and, you know, grab a camera and take our picture. You know, it's like, no, don't be a dick. Don't just walk out. Just know the fact that he was in proximity and keep going. And I think that's more appreciated than anything else.
Yeah.
So what am I going to say? I like Manhattan. Everybody liked Manhattan.
Yeah.
So.
But I loved his movies. He made some great movies.
He makes, I'm interested in the new one he's got called...
Midnight in Paris.
Midnight in Paris, yeah. that also looks like it gets a little bit into... I don't know. It's hard to say what it's about, but it looks like it's a young lovers traveling in Paris and... the character played by Owen Wilson, it looks a little almost like Brigadoon, like he stumbles into part of Paris that only exists at midnight, and it seems to be like old Paris, the Paris of either the 20s or before that, the turn of the last century Paris, and he becomes kind of entranced by it. Again, I don't know. It could be about anything. Great stuff. You know, a little bit of bizarreness.
I always thought that Julie Kavner was the appropriate girlfriend for him.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah.
Whenever they were together in the movies, I mean, and I don't know, he wants those willowy Midwestern girls, but when they were together on the screen, I always thought, there's a couple. That's a movie we should see.
It's interesting that he always cast her in kind of like a maternal role in his movies, like in Radio Days. She plays what's basically his mother, and or the mother of the narrator character. And then in Hannah and Her Sisters, she's like his co-producer.
They're great together.
Yeah.
No, I'm just, this is off the subject, but I saw Alfred Hitchcock was another hero.
Yeah.
That's what we were talking about.
Sure.
Woody Allen and Alfred Hitchcock. Don't ask me.
I don't know.
But I saw him. I've seen him twice in person.
Hitchcock.
Wow. And the first time was at the first AFI festival, which was it must be about 30 years. It was when Family Plot came out.
Maybe yeah.
Bring that out. And it was in Century City, and everybody was on the second floor looking down or all around as they were bringing in. They brought in this coffin, and you thought that he might be in the coffin.
Huh.
But they opened it up, and they took out the cans of the film, and then they brought it into the theater. And then he came with his wife, Alma, and it was like such a thrill. To see Alfred Hitchcock in person. And inside, he introduced the film, and then he left. And then, like about 2 years later, I was a page at NBC.
Uh-huh.
And we were sent down again to Century City, to the Century City Hotel. And there was this Hollywood banquet for, of all people, Henry Kissinger. But everybody was there in this huge lobby area in front of the banquet hall. And I mean, in front of me, like 5 feet in front of me, there was Johnny Carson and Kirk Douglas, and I forget the third person, but somebody of that stature.
Wow.
And that was just part of this group. And it was just
Hollywood
unbelievable.
Night.
It was just great. And so anyways, I was assigned to guard a door. Nobody was to get past this door. So I'm sitting there listening to Johnny Carson and Kirk Douglas tell jokes to each other. And the crowd is mulling around, and for a moment it sort of like separates.
Yeah.
And this is a big lobby, and I'm looking through the separation, and there's Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, my God.
Who's on the other side, sitting down.
Uh-huh.
They had like a sitting area, I guess, but it wasn't chairs, it was like a bench area. And I'm looking, there's Alfred Hitchcock, and I'm at this door. I want to go see Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah.
I don't want to stay at this door. I have to go. And suddenly they called everybody to come get into the room, and the doors open. And I had lost my chance to see him at that time because he was being escorted by two people on either side. His legs were very bad.
Oh.
And so they took him into this, he got lost with the sea of celebrities into this room, this banquet room. And I stayed outside because I thought maybe I'll stay for a while and maybe I can catch him coming out. And I just want to say you're a hero of mine.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't going to happen. But I did meet his chauffeur.
Oh, okay.
And his chauffeur said, we were talking, and his chauffeur said that he essentially, his legs were so bad, I guess he had arthritis, that he essentially directed that movie, at least all the exteriors, and there were a few exteriors in that thing, from his limousine.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I found that, we've talked about some other stuff, but I found that interesting. And then he died not too much later.
What was his last movie, Frenzy?
No, it was Family Plot.
Family Plot.
And it wasn't, it was written by Ernest Lehman. And there's something flat about that movie, but there are certain scenes that you remember. There's an archbishop who gets kidnapped in front of the church,
right?
Which was very clever because it was like nobody in the church wanted to stand up and do anything, even though they were watching this happen. And because people are, when they're in an institution, they tend to want to stay. Be what they are in that institution, and they did not. And so it was just a clever way to have a crime happen in front of people where people are not apt to get up to help.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. And then there's another interesting shot where the where the guy's walking through a cemetery and the camera rises. And this, and it's interesting to me that he thought of this shot. The camera rises and it's over this guy's head as he's walking through the cemetery, and it's like he's walking through a painting of squares. It was very, it's interesting, but otherwise it's not such a hot movie. But yeah,
every one of his movies has some great touch in it, you know, some unexpected thing that just makes,
well, you know, Batman, we were doing Batman,
I
put a lot of Hitchcock into Batman. I stole jokes and stuff. So there was a scene where Batman tumbles into a woman's room and she goes, "Oh my," and then she stops and says, "Oh my." That's straight out of Cary Grant coming into a woman's hotel room as he's trying to escape the authorities.
Yeah.
He says something else, I forget what, but that was a steal.
I remember on we were doing Tiny Toons. The first cartoon Bruce Timm and I did on Tiny Toons was he boarded the whole thing for Art Vitello, who directed it. It was, we did a shot by shot parody of the shower scene in Psycho.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have parodied it since, but Bruce got down every little nuance of where the little Tasmanian devil is taking a shower and Elmira comes in and works him over with a scrub brush. But the way he did it was just, it was perfect. It was fun referencing, shot by shot.
They did a reshot of, Psycho. Who's the director's name? I'm just the worst with names.
Toby Hooper?
No, it was...
Oh, no, it was Gus Van Sant.
Thank you. It was also a favorite director of mine.
Yeah.
And people, poo-pooed that. Uh-huh. But I really found that movie really interesting.
Huh.
That he would do it shot for shot.
That was fascinating.
Wasn't it?
To just have the balls to do something like that even. But color threw me off.
Yeah, the color... Yeah, it does.
Yeah, because the blood and all that stuff in the shower sequence, it just didn't have the same impact.
There's a moment in the original Psycho. Who's the detective? Martin Balsam in that?
Yeah.
The scariest shot for me in Psycho is the one where he's walking up the stairs, and then they go to that down shot of him striding in quickly, and there's no sound for a second until he stabs him, if I'm remembering correctly.
Probably are.
But it's like, and it's just, it goes to that shot where you see the killer coming, you know, abruptly. It's not like he just strides into frame, and that's scarier. There's something when it's well done, when you see the killer or the monster or whatever it is at a distance getting closer, rather than just, you know, the close up on the scared girl who backs up and then turns and it's right there.
Yeah.
You know, there's something almost about the idea that you are watching the victim who has no idea that something is coming, and that for a brief second makes you want to scream out like "get away" or "look out" or something like that. And I think when that's well done, that's a masterful shot.
Looking back on that movie, you're kind of amazed. I was fooled. I guess everybody was fooled.
Uh-huh.
But you look back on it and you see how simple it was, the manner in which he fooled you was. And you're kind of amazed by it. But I guess, it was a new idea that split personalities in movies were a new idea, I think, at that time.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what helped make it work.
It also was sort of like the rise of the anti-hero in movies. You know, like, even though Norman Bates is... like arguably the villain, the movie.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you see so much of him in like a positive light, or like when he's first talking to Janet Leigh, it's like, you don't know, is this guy a creep or is he warm or nice? Or he's sort of like a tortured heroic type guy.
Right.
And then only at the end you get the full picture on him. And
even
then you still feel like, was he completely responsible for what he did?
Or was mom?
Yeah, I remember I remember when I was a kid, I stayed up late because I wanted to watch The Birds on TV. I was too little to see it in the theaters. And then a few years later, they showed it on TV, and I was still too little. You know, my folks were like, it's really going to scare you. And I'm going like, well, it's birds attacking people. But I didn't know they showed, eyes being pecked out and everything. Yeah. And it gave me the willies, and I'm watching it like this, and at that age, I didn't really understand the ambiguity of movies, it's sort of like an ambiguity of movies that was prevalent then and we seem to have lost now. For instance, at the end when they drive away and all the birds are there, I'm going like, what's going to happen? You know, or is the world doomed? Or, I mean, These are the good people. Shouldn't they be allowed to escape? Are the birds going to follow them? Is mankind just screwed from this point onward?
No.
You know, and now I think if they remade that movie, they would, you know, they would have to go out and kill every bird and then announce the plague is over and say happy.
Yeah, anytime anything's left ambiguous, audiences get upset. Look at Lost.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. But I think... I remember, you know, the movie was very unsettling for those reasons, because as a kid, you sort of want, oh, okay, the dragon is dead, we're all happy. So there was that. That was kicking around in my brain for about a week, and then my family said, we're going to go visit some friends up the coast. And I said, okay. So we piled in the car. Where are we going? Well, we're going to a little town called Bolinas. Bolinas, okay. And then we went to exactly where they had shot the movie.
Yeah.
And
with the phone booth and everything?
Everything is there. And we were staying in a big Victorian house, and it was windy, and branches were hitting the tree. I was going, the birds are going to pick my eyes up.
Covering his face.
God. That did a number on me. And I guess that's the closest you come to making a creature movie, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, something that had a not human.
Yeah, supernatural-ish element
to
it.
Yeah.
Well, that was also great because there's that no music score throughout the movie. It just made it a lot more creepy and tense. And
yeah.
I don't know how they got away with that. Just worked so well.
Yeah, usually, yeah, I don't know. You know, filmmakers, when they can show a monster, you know, nowadays, you know, you can do anything in CGI. It's always some big, drooling, 18-foot-tall creature. But, you know, Hitchcock's got, you know, little birds to deal with. That makes it all creepy. All
not the finches.
That reminds me of a time, like, when we were working on some of the Steven Spielberg projects. Steven came by your office one day, and we had him for a few minutes, and you were asking him a couple of filmmaking questions.
I asked him
about that shot in Jaws, where the
shot in Jaws, my favorite shot in Jaws,
where he stabs the knife in the side of the boat.
Yeah, there's a scene where they're on the boat in the end. We're in the third act, and everything is falling apart.
Yeah,
and Robert Shaw has this machete. And he takes it, and in disgust, he stabs it in the side of on the rim of the boat. And for a second, the machete just vibrates, and it's reflected in the sun. And you have this two reflections: this machete and this water. And I said to him, I said, that's like an abstract painting of the entire film. And I said, where did you come up with that? I mean, was that boarded? He said, no, it wasn't boarded. He said, you have to leave some shots. You have to get artistic, you know. In other words, make it up as you go along and find some shots to add some poetry to the scene. But what he said that made me just like smile for the rest of the day was that you're the first person who has ever pointed out that shot.
Wow. He was very pleased about that because he knew exactly the shot.
It's a great shot.
It is, and I think it's like one of those happy moments where it just happens, and it's like, hey, let's get that.
It's a great shot.
Yeah. There's a moment in It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Where Jimmy Stewart is leaving his... They have a reception for his brother, and he's walking out with his Uncle Billy, who's very drunk.
Yeah.
And there's this moment where Uncle Billy goes, I feel so good, I'm going to spit in Potter's eye. Yes, I'm going to do that. And he goes off singing My Wild Irish Rose, and he staggers off. And then apparently what happened was, that was his exit, but somebody, one of the crew members, dropped a whole thing of film canisters with this horrible crash just off screen. You can see Jimmy Stewart kind of look toward it. The actor playing Uncle Billy instantly goes, I'm all right. And they kept it. You know, it was just that, you know, a lucky disaster that happened, and Jimmy Stewart's smile was so natural in response to what he did.
Yeah.
It seems like that's also one of those moments when they just happen. You kind of go with it and put it in because it just adds something to it. Well, any final thoughts? Any final thoughts on Batman or things you want to talk about coming up?
You know, I just wish the Emerald Knights all the good cheer and a lot of fans and. I mean, I wish it a great success. So, because it was done by a whole bunch of people, and they deserve to see their product be seen.
Man, this is great. This fascinating trip down memory lane. But Ezra is giving me the kind of the wind it up symbol. We're getting, you know, every time we go over a half hour, we feel like people are listening. They're probably doing their laundry or something. They tune off. They tune out after 35 minutes. So I think we'll cut it here. But we'll come back next week for part two with Alan Burnett. Can you make it?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Sounds okay.
Good. See everyone then.
Great.
Leave us some iTunes reviews, everyone. Have a great day.